I want to talk for a moment about nice feminists. They come in a variety of flavors, but these are the ones whose goals, although pursued under the banner of feminism, are reasonable and indeed virtuous goals. The decriminalization and normalizing of prostitution, for example. While many people, both inside and outside the men's rights movement, dislike the idea of prostitution, I think it's safe to say that it won't be done away with by keeping it illegal. Criminalization only makes it more dangerous and harmful to everyone involved, both on the provider and the consumer end of the equation. Okay, great. That's nice. And there are other issues. Porn, for example, argued as a legitimate form of performance for gainful employment. Surely it's every woman's right to get naked and be paid to do so, if she chooses. Alright, that's essentially the same issue in a different wrapper, and one need not be feminist to support those causes, but you take my point. And in view of that point, when one looks in from outside of the umbrella of feminism, outside the radical camp, outside the liberal camp, outside the I want to be paid for sex camp, surely from outside the various camps, all flying the same flag, the flag of feminism, well, surely it's unkind, unfair, and uncalled for to universally condemn feminism as a monolith, without regard for just which of the 364 flavors we're talking about when we use that endlessly flexible label. Well, for all those who would cry from the rooftops that not all feminists are like that, for those self-labeled feminists who may indeed be pursuing legitimate humanistic goals, I'm going to try to explain, yet again, why I speak ill of the gender ideology known as feminism, and why not a single fuck is given by me as to what subspecies of that ideology you may happen to subscribe to. And if what I'm about to tell you upsets you or makes you feel vilified or put upon, I've got some big girl panties you can borrow. I agree. There are self-described feminists whose goals are legitimate. I agree that decriminalizing matters of personal choice and bodily autonomy are important and worthy goals. And to the extent that I can, I will support and promote those goals, independent of whatever political label you or anyone else pursues them under. However, the humanist, liberal, sex-positive, nice-guy version of feminism you practice, and if I didn't cover your particular flavor, go ahead and add it in. That humanist feminism is not the same ideology taught in university gender studies courses. It is not the feminism which informs the policies of the United Nations aid agencies who render assistance to only women and children, and not to men. That feminism is not the feminism of the leader of the free world, who feels that female dominance in education is equality, and that female dominance in education must be expanded through legislation in order to ensure even greater, equality? Your humanist version of feminism is not the one which specifically excludes male gang rape victims from receiving medical aid, shelter, and rehabilitation in places where male-targeted gang rape are standard practices of war, such as in the Congo. That feminism is not your humanist feminism. Neither is your feminism the version which in Canada informs a $20 million charity, which produces egregiously and grotesquely misleading ad campaigns designed to, and guaranteed to acculturate hatred and fear of men in women, and to teach girls to always think of themselves as victims first and self-actualized adults never. That's not your humanist feminism either. Your humanist feminism is not the ideology informing almost all domestic violence shelters and public messaging on domestic violence, selling a totally false story that domestic violence is evil, violent men beating on sweetly innocent and helpless female victims. Which, by the way, aside from continuously demonizing men, is guaranteed to not stop domestic violence since it is working from a totally broken model. And your flavor of feminism is not the one informing a collection of lawyers, social workers, educators, childcare specialists, psychologists, community coordinators, and other professionals to collaborate on a blog and cheer for plans to eugenically exterminate the male half of the human race. So yes, nay fault, nay fault, nay fault. I understand Your feminism, with its admirable goals and complete lack of influence in society, comprised of a teeny tiny, unfunded, unorganized minority whose dissent is to the vanguard of your movement what a gnat is to a muskox. Your feminism is true feminism. Sure, it's not the feminism that informs domestic policy, writes advisory papers and reports for the UN, or eradicates due process on college and university campuses. The people who do all that are the other feminism. You know, the feminism that isn't true feminism. The big, funded, established, wealth-bloated, politically powerful version of the ideology. And heck, you don't even talk to those people. You don't even get invited to their parties. But I hate to break it to you, honey. When you pursue your noble humanistic goals under the banner of feminism, even when you prefix it, even when you say liberal feminism, or humanist feminism, or sex-positive feminism, you're giving cover and support and ballast to those who abandon male rape victims, or see men's ever-widening marginalization in education as evidence of equality, or openly call for the extermination of men. I'm going to say that again. When you pursue your noble goals under the banner of feminism, even when you prefix it, you are giving cover and support and ballast to every single well-funded and tenured bigot who wears the badge, even those who openly call for the extermination of men. And that's why I don't care what flavor of feminism you practice. You're using the same brand name as murderous eugenics enthusiasts, destroy due process, sexual apartheid, gender ideologues, for whom violence isn't just an unpleasant option. Violence, when contemplated against men or male children, is what gets them wet. That's the big, funded, organized, and politically established flavor of the ideology you use the name of. And while I know you're a humanist, you're not murderous, and you wouldn't dream of using violence to attain your goals, well, fuck you. If you self-identify as a feminist, you're flying under the banner of a totalitarian, violent, amoral, murderous ideology of sexual apartheid and hatred. If your goals are legitimate, pursue them. And again, you'll have my total support. But if you fly the flag of hatred and violence, don't expect me to pat you on the head and say, "That's okay, I know you're one of the nice ones." Fuck you. Grow up and stop pretending there's no problem using the same flag as those who advocate eugenics and mass murder. Grow up! And thank you for your kind attention.
And that was Karen, Girl Writes What, also today's guest, doing her nice feminism rant. And this is Gnostic Media Research and Publishing's podcast episode number 146. I'm your host, Jan Irvin. Today for this controversial subject on feminism, I'm joined by my girlfriend Sarah, who acts as co-host. This episode is an interview with Karen, host of Girl Writes What, titled The Feminist Fallacy, and is being released on Friday, July 20, 2012. My interview with Karen was recorded on Tuesday, July 17, 2012. Girl Writes What is a divorced mother of three, university dropout, and author of erotica who also writes and vlogs about gender issues. She considers herself both anti-feminist and anti-traditional, and has characterized feminism as paternalism in lipstick. She describes her philosophy as the radical notion that women are adults. Upcoming shows. Joe Atwill is back as soon as I manage to get this video interview edited, and also Lisa Graves will be here from Alec Exposed to discuss the American Legislative Council, or ALEC. And let's see, donations. This episode is dedicated to Carlos, Lewis, William, Kim, who donated twice. Thank you, Kim. Arthur, Scott, Stephen, Jason, and Jeremy. And the widget for the video and book project, The Secret History of Magic Mushrooms, like I said last week, is going a bit slow. I may take it down. We did get a few donations in towards the project this week. I really thank you to all of those who donated for that. And the more funds we raise, the more we'll be able to apply directly to that project. So again, I appreciate all of your help. And to those who've donated towards the new book and DVD project, as I've said in the past, I will be mentioning your donations in relation with that project as we get that done. So I appreciate your patience. And we do our best to provide just about everything here at Gnostic Media for free. So please do your best to donate all you can and help support what we do. This show is run on donations and our website sales. This is not corporate media, but independent media in the truest sense of the words. And by donating or ordering one of the books or DVDs or the She Who Remembers audio archives, a t-shirt, or if you get a membership for downloading the older podcasts, you help to continue this unprogramming. And of course, we greatly appreciate your support. And the views expressed by the authors and guests of this unprogram are their own and are not necessarily those held by myself, the host, or Gnostic Media. You can go to Gnostic Media at www.gnosticmedia.com. That's GNOSTICmedia.com. You can contact me through the contact form on the website or directly at contact@gnosticmedia.com. Please also check out the Tragedy and Hope website and the Peace Revolution podcast, the School Sucks podcast, James Corbett's Corbett Report, and James Evan Pilato's Media Monarchy. And as a last note, the gain on my microphone got messed up while trying to get two mics set up, so my apologies in advance for my audio not being great. Thankfully, everyone else's is fine. It's just me that sounds like crap. Thanks for listening, and thank you for your support. Here's my interview with Karen, Girl Writes What? The Feminist Fallacy. Enjoy. So, Karen, welcome to the Gnostic Media Podcast. I'm excited to have you here, or we're actually excited to have you here. I'm here with Sarah today, and it's her first time joining me as a co-host for the Gnostic Media Podcast, and I felt it would be good to have another woman's perspective along with yours on this very hot topic, hot potato topic. And so I'm going to let the both of you hopefully do most of the talking, and I've got some questions to ask to lead along the way. But welcome to the show, and why don't you start off by telling us a little bit about yourself and your educational background, etc.
Well, I'm a divorced mother of three in my early 40s, and my educational background would, I guess it's that I dropped out of university twice. I really don't have any formal educational background.
What was your major when you were in the university?
I was going into education. It was sort of my parents talked me into it, you know, try and have a profession. And I was going to go into education to teach high school English and biology. And I just found that that it was just not for me. I hated school all the way through. And it's not that I didn't get good marks. It's not that I didn't do well on tests and stuff like that. I just really, really found the formatting of it just rubbed me the wrong way. So,
sure. And I think if you ever get into John Taylor Gatto's work, you'll find all of that laid out there for you very clearly.
Oh, I'm sure. I watched a little bit of his stuff, and he seems to be quite critical of the way the system is set up. And I found that when my kids, especially when they were in elementary school, the kinds of materials that they would come home with sort of in the social responsibility area of school, you know, information on the environment and information on social studies and things like that, a lot of it just was extremely not necessarily fact-based. And I found that quite annoying. So it was not quite to that degree when I was going through the system, but it seems to be highly politicized now. So,
all right. Well, how did you get involved in studying and fighting against feminism?
That's kind of an interesting question. I was always sort of one of those people that I had never, ever defined myself as a feminist, never ever labeled myself as that. Most of most of what I knew about feminism just seemed to be sort of contrary to reality, just sort of a biased way of looking at things. And I guess it wasn't until shortly after my divorce, I had been writing books for a while, just erotic fiction, and I was participating on a website for readers and writers and reviewers, where they'd done a post saying, let's all go laugh at these guys over here. And I went over and I read the article that they'd linked to, and it was an article about how science fiction was becoming feminized, and there was really no such thing as hard science fiction anymore. There was always some kind of subplot of romance or soap opera stuff, and that, you know, you just can't find books or movies that are just for men anymore. And I thought it was kind of a really silly thing to whine about. And when I was going through the comments, somebody said something about how he'd just ripped the new Star Trek off the internet and it was awesome and he was going to watch it 10 times. And I was like, okay, well, there's your problem, guys, right? Like, nobody's going to make movies specifically for the demographic most likely to steal them. They make movies for people who pay for them, and girls drag their boyfriends to the theaters. They pay for DVDs. They do that. So maybe you guys could work on your habits and, you know, and maybe stop whining about this because you're creating your own problem. And then I went and I read some of the other articles on the website, and I realized that some of those articles were not just whining over nothing. They were discussing some pretty serious issues like domestic violence law and rape law and all kinds of just the misinformation that gets spread around on those topics in particular. And the more I read, the more I realized that we're all kind of living in a paradigm that's been invented.
Indeed. All right. Let's ask, you know what, and let me give Sarah a chance to say hello here.
Hello.
Hi, nice to meet you.
Yeah, it's interesting. I would have classified myself at one point as a feminist, and I could definitely, in your video blog about To the Nice Feminists, I could see myself in there, and it was like a good dose of reality to listen to what you had to say in that.
I think most women can get behind the idea of equality. I mean, I'm certainly for equality. But there seems to be this idea that equality means elevating women in all the ways that they are less than equal, without elevating men in all the ways they are less than equal. And what you end up with is just this completely uneven situation. And feminism does not seem to want to address that, so...
Why don't you tell us, what is feminism?
That's a tough one. There's a whole bunch of different schools of thought. Most of them seem to agree on the nature of the problem. And when you boil it all down, the nature of the problem is men. There's a lot of different factions that argue. I mean, some of them really hate each other. The sex-positive feminists and sex-negative feminists are at each other's throats all the time. Basically, it's how the disagreements come in. What are we going to fix? But generally, when they go back to the nature of the problem seems to always come down to men are the problem. You know, or male dominance is the problem, or patriarchy is the problem, the system headed by men, or, you know, men created all the problems. And it's just an extremely simplistic way of looking at the situation. And if you buy into what they say the problem is, all of your efforts in every direction, no matter whether you're sex positive, liberal, libertarian, conservative feminist, you know, no matter what kind of feminist you are, you're going to be attacking it in the wrong way. You're going to be unbalancing things even further. So,
where did feminism originate? Do you know?
That's another tough one. Basically, because feminism has existed through periods of history, not under the name, but sort of as a philosophy or as an expansion of freedoms and powers for women, in the near the end of the Roman Empire and at other times through history. So, I mean, it's really hard to pinpoint, when did it all start? I guess probably one of the earliest feminists that has a lot of traction now would be Mary Wollstonecraft. And she was an extremely unusual person. And she grew up in a sort of an upper crust household. When the family fell on hard times, her father confiscated her trust fund to pay the bills, which basically just means that she had a trust fund to confiscate in the first place. And she was one of only 17% of the population that could read and write well enough to sign her own name. But she felt that women should not have privileges anymore. And this is why a lot of people who advocate for men really feel like she had the answers. But then when you look at where she came from and what she did with her life, her father was abusive, used to beat her mother. She would lie down across her mother's bedroom door to keep him out and protect her mom. And she, at one point, her sister had been newly married and had a new baby, and she was suffering postpartum depression, the speculation is. And Mary convinced her to leave her husband and child, made arrangements for her and everything, and then didn't stick around for the lifetime of poverty and drudgery that ensued for her sister. She went off to France and hung out with a bunch of intellectuals, and she had a child out of wedlock. When the father of her child didn't want to be with her, she attempted suicide twice. This is at a time in history where Oliver Twist was reality fiction. So you're looking at, she's the only person between her child and, a life in the workhouse. And that didn't matter if she couldn't have the man she wanted. And so, I mean, like, even when you look at her writings on their own, and you think, well, yeah, that's awesome. It really is only awesome in this kind of environment that we live in now. I don't think that that would have been even remotely possible in her time. And I think, why it didn't quite catch on the way she wanted it to. But I guess probably, if you want to look at the earliest piece of feminist activism, it would have been probably the Tender Years Doctrine at the end of the 19th century, which basically put ownership of children after divorce in the mother's hands. So at least up until age 8 or something like that. And so it was default mother custody was what they lobbied for and had that written into law. And then, of course, there was the suffrage movement, and which was closely tied with the temperance movement. And some of the suffragettes were white feather girls who would go around calling men in civilian clothes cowards to shame them into enlisting during World War I. So there was a lot of female activism going on at that time, and some of it was feminism, some of it was religious.
That just sounds like a Edward Bernays type of PSYOP project there, Have you ever read Edward Bernays' book, Propaganda?
No, I have not.
Yeah, he's the father of propaganda and created a lot of the techniques. In fact, he was the one that got women to smoke cigarettes by having hundreds of women marched through New York smoking cigarettes and calling them liberty torches, and stuff like this. And, so he was behind a lot of these types of things. And that just, to me, just when you explain it, it sounds like one of his types of operations.
Well, it really was. Feminism was really opposed in large part by women. When you look at suffrage, it wasn't until female opposition to suffrage was outweighed by female support for it that they finally ratified that amendment and gave women the vote. I even remember there was a political cartoon I saw of Taft with his head in his hands, just looking miserable. And there's a woman on either side of him with a placard screaming at him, and one saying votes for women and the other saying no to suffrage. It really wasn't until women kind of came to a consensus that they wanted that, that the men in power just kind of unilaterally did that. But really, it seems to be that from everything that I've seen as far as female activism and how that works, it seems to me like it doesn't matter whether it's 100% men in power. If the women all agree that they want something, and if it's at all possible to provide that to them, then they get it. So,
all right. Why, in your opinion, is feminism bad?
Because it's not based on fact. I think what I've said before, that they broke Sherlock Holmes's first rule, right? You start with the evidence. And then once you have all the evidence that you can find, then you craft your theory. What they started was, they started with feelings, and then they crafted the theory around the feelings. And then they went out and looked for the evidence to prove that their theory was correct, and that, you know, that they were right to feel that they, the way they did.
Sure.
So, I mean, they sometimes they asked the right questions, but they never asked all the questions that needed to be asked. For instance, when they were researching domestic violence, and the amazing thing is that, you know, you can see posters, vintage posters online of men at whipping posts in America and in the UK getting 30 lashes for beating their wives, right?
Right.
But it was, who is it? Lord Blackstone. He made it clear in his big book of English law that it was not only illegal to use violence against your wife, but you were not even allowed to use restraint on her. So, you know, this, they looked for the facts that they wanted to find. And some of the questions that they never asked were, they never asked men about whether their wives beat them. They never asked women whether they hit their husbands, right? And they basically ignored all of that history, a history full of things like public floggings and pistols at dawn and lynchings of people who beat or raped women, all of these vigilante justice all over the place, church groups are running men out of town when they beat their wives. They ignored all that. They said, well, that was back when society condoned wife battering, right? And they never bothered to look into the history of what happened to battered husbands, which was, if a man was battered by his wife back in the 1700s, he got to ride around town seated backwards on a donkey holding its tail while people threw stuff at him.
Wow.
Yeah. Society didn't condone women battering their husbands. They just punished the men for it.
Man.
So...
Yeah, I mean, and you've got a video on YouTube about the whole history of that. Would you go into a little bit more of that and just?
Well, it was really a way of enforcing male responsibility.
What was the importance of enforcing male responsibility there?
Well, because men were responsible for their wives' actions. They were responsible for their wives' deaths.
Okay, let's go into this because, you know, most people don't realize that the men were responsible for their wives' actions. So what does that mean? What's the depth of that?
Well, it was actually sort of a legal... women, when they married, their person was sort of legally subsumed by their husband. So we look at coverture, and which is what the law was, coverture, and we say, oh, well, she wasn't even a person in her own right, and he owned her like chattel, and she was considered, you know, not even a child under the law, and she wasn't allowed to own her own property, and she wasn't allowed to have her own money, and she wasn't allowed to have any freedom. But at the same time, this was a time where when you went into debt, you didn't call, you know, Consolidated Credit and get credit counseling. You went to prison, right? And if you committed any number, dozens sometimes in some areas, of crimes, you swung from a rope. And the flip side of coverture was that men were actually held criminally culpable and financially culpable for their wives' crimes and debts. So if she went out and committed a crime, he could be punished for it because he allowed that to happen.
And so obviously then, if the wife abused the husband, then he wasn't doing his job in keeping her in line and hence riding backwards on an ass.
Yeah, well, this is the whole reason why the public whipping post was the preferred way of punishing a wife batterer, was because if you put him in prison, right, not only was she deprived of his income, right, so she was put into financial hardship. Not only that, if you find him, that would be paid out of the family purse, and she would have to endure that financial hardship. So those two punished the woman along with the husband. The whipping post, you could give him 30 lashes and he can go to work the next day. And when it came to the reason why coverture existed, it did exist in large part to protect women. It protected them from the consequences of their own actions. It protected them from the consequences of their misdeeds, of their foolish behavior, if they were going to behave foolishly. It protected them in all those ways. It put all of the burden and all of the responsibility for making sure she is safe and she's not getting into trouble and she's not having any kind of hardships and she's not in danger and she's safe and sound. It put all of the onus for doing that on the man. And in order to have him be able to be a bodyguard and a handler and basically stand between his wife and all of the harshness and dangers of the world, he had to have authority over her. You can't say to a bodyguard, okay, well, this is the person that you have to keep safe. And if they get hurt, it's your responsibility. It's your fault. And if they get into trouble, it's also your fault and you'll be held accountable. But, oh, by the way, they don't have to do anything you say.
Right.
So, you know, it was really an attempt at balancing out. The men had the authority because they needed to have it. If they didn't have it, they couldn't be held responsible.
All right, Karen, many accuse you of being a feminist or having some agenda for spreading hate against women and feminism. What is your response to this?
I actually had someone on a men's rights blog tell me that I was the woman feminism promised but never delivered. And that was an awesome compliment. It really was. It basically says it all. It's, you know, you are actually an egalitarian. You are actually somebody who wants to have some kind of equity between the genders, not just more and more and more for women. But I don't know. I don't think that anybody can accuse me anymore since I came out with more and more, you know, material that I hate women. I used to get that accusation a lot, that I hate women, that I'm self-hating. They used to accuse me of being a man before I started making videos. They just, anti-feminism, guilty as charged, right? But anti-feminism and misogyny are not the same thing. So.
All right. And you just mentioned, and I've seen some of your videos, women and feminists saying that you're too manly or too guyish or, something along these lines. What do you have to say about that?
Well, before I started doing videos, I had so many accusations. Like, people would literally not believe that I was a woman. Or they would say that I was, because my boyfriend was often online in these same places. And I'd be like, I'm living with this guy. And that you're just his sock puppet. And I even had one, you know, grab lots and lots of comments that I'd made and pick them apart sort of in a literary sense to prove that I had a masculine literary voice and therefore I had to be a man. And I think that's pretty much the primary reason why I started making videos, was because they can really dismiss what you have to say about this stuff if you're a man. And
you know that's the irony of it, because we're the victims of this.
Yeah.
And you know, and any time that the women are a victim of something, they're given the attention to, but if we're the victim of something, then we're completely ignored. And
you're
so
voiceless.
Right, we're voiceless, and so we have to turn to a woman like you to get our voice out.
Well, you're not allowed to speak to that. You're not allowed to be an activist on your own behalf. You are not allowed to talk about men's problems. And this is where, and you hear this kind of shaming, especially ironically from, feminists seem to think that shaming women based on their sexuality is bad, and shaming people based on their homosexuality is bad, and shaming people, slut shaming is horrible, and all of this shaming as far as sexuality goes is just a horrible, horrible injustice. But then they'll turn around and they will accuse men's rights people of being angry, fat, bitter, neckbeard losers who live in their mother's basements and can't get laid.
Right.
So, yeah. You are just a creep. You're a pervert. You're a virgin.
There's always an ad hominem when it's against the men, but it's never acceptable against them. And I mean, you know, neither side should be using them at all. And if people stripped away all of the fallacies and started using some critical thinking, you know, we wouldn't even have to have this conversation.
Well, what I find extremely funny is that when I actually get into, you know, sort of a debate with feminists, and sometimes they're really hardcore feminists, and sometimes they're quite relaxed as far as, I guess, by comparison. But they always end up speculating about my personal life. You know, you must be someone who your boyfriend must beat you, or, you know, obviously your boyfriend treats you like a doormat, or obviously you abuse your boyfriend. It's clear to me that you do, you know, or obviously this, obviously that, obviously your divorce made you bitter, obviously all of these things about my personal life, because they can't accept that really nothing happened to me. Like, there's really nothing that, I mean,
you just didn't buy the BS, and that's the end of the story.
Well, I mean, like, I had an absurdly, it was an absurdly average normal upbringing in an absurdly average middle class family. And my parents loved each other. I don't think I ever heard one of them tell the other to shut up my entire childhood. They respected each other. They expected respect from their kids. And they're still together after like 50 years.
Wow.
You know, so, I mean, there I am having this upbringing, and, you know, my marriage was, you know, I worked hard at it, harder than probably sane. But, I mean, even that was not a big, I mean, if anything, that would turn me into a feminist, right. Not the other way around. So.
Right.
I don't know where they get all of the speculations. They have to explain it somehow. I must be abnormal in some way to not buy into the zeitgeist.
You know, your work has made me think of something that I remember as a young boy that was a little bit disturbing for me and I never got. And it was, what are little boys made of? And, you know, the typical story is, what are little boys made of? Slugs and snails and puppy dogs' tails. What are little girls made of? Sugar and spice and everything nice. And, you know, I remember, you know, as a child, this hitting me and you know, bothering me. And it was your work and listening to all of your stuff that kind of made this, you know, come back to me and remember it. And so, you know, it's... that even in the nursery rhymes, boys are taught that they're dirty and worthless and that girls are special and upheld.
Well, I think, too, the old nursery rhyme, that basically says it's your job or will be your job as a man to get yourself dirty, to deal with unpleasant things, right, so that she won't have to, so that her life can be sugar and spice.
Right.
Yeah, that's amazing.
So, and I really don't think that feminism has done anything at all to challenge the sort of the nature of, it won't even admit that sexism against men exists.
Right.
And it won't address the nature of the fact that sexism against women, whether it expresses itself as in hostile ways that are harmful to women, or in extremely benevolent ways, like, I don't know, like 48 counts of child rape and she got 3 years. So just recently, I read an article on that. So basically she was, no, wait, she had 53. Jerry Sandusky had 48. And she gets 3 years, and they expect that he'll spend his life in prison. So that's benevolent sexism. And all of the sort of hostile expressions of sexism all seem to be based or have their origins in a benevolent force, as far as women are valuable. They are valuable in and of themselves. They should be protected. They should be provided for. And all of the sexism against men that I've come across has really been what I've sort of described as utilitarian sexism. Basically, we decide what we want for women, and we tell men it's your job to do that, and if you don't, you're in trouble.
What are some of the effects of on men of feminism?
It really, you know, one of the primary aspects of masculine identity is that men need to be useful. If they're not useful, they cease to exist, really, as human beings in the eyes of the rest of society. And feminism has basically not just done what it can to remove any dependence, any direct dependence we have on men, but they've actually gone so far as, you know, a woman needs a man like a fish needs a bicycle. Who needs men? Mary Daly, you know, the earth should be only 10% male. All of these things that they've discussed as, like, we don't need men anymore, therefore we can get rid of them. And, you know, I don't know that there's ever been a conversation like that in all of history about women.
Yeah.
We're always going to need women.
You know, as far as, you know, my life, I'm 41 years old, and I never, ever, any place, at anywhere, at any time, have I ever heard men talking about that whatsoever.
Well, I mean, you hear the jokes, right? Like, oh, women can't live with him, can't shoot him in the back of the head or whatever, right?
Well, yeah, but, you know, we never say, let's go get rid of all of the women or anything like that, you know?
You really don't. And then you have university professors, like Mary Daly was a professor at, I think, Boston University, and she thought that if humanity was going to survive, we needed a decontamination of the earth, and it would sort of necessitate reducing the population of men to about 10% of the human race. There was another feminist, I can never remember her name, there are so many, who basically said 10% men, just keep them around to do the heavy lifting and to generate genetic material. And other than that, let's just get rid of them.
Man, it's so incredible.
Let's get into Thomas Ball, who lit himself on fire in front of a courthouse a year ago in, where was that, Keene County? And what can you tell us about him and his situation?
Well, I can't really tell you a whole lot. I did read about it. I read most of his manifesto, which was extremely long and quite rambly and disjointed, because clearly he was upset when he wrote it. But from what I gather, what happened was he hit one of his children, sort of, you know, just kind of lost his temper for a second and slapped her. And his wife was very upset by this, and she discussed the incident with a neighbor, and the neighbor told her that if she didn't call child services or report what he'd done, she could be held responsible for it. And so she did. And then this kind of started the steamroller of the system, which ended up they got a restraining order against him. He was kicked out of the house. He was put on trial. He went through the ringer. He all of a sudden, it's like 3 years later, and he still hasn't seen his kids. And he said that his wife was naive and that she regretted what she had done to start all of this. I'm not sure, because when, you know, you're only getting one side of the story, right? You're only getting his version of events. So it may have fallen out completely differently, but at the point where he was just sort of at the end of his string and he'd been looking into things, he'd been looking into the law, the Constitution, the laws that are actually on the books, and then what he called the second set of books. And the second set of books aren't actually written anywhere. They're not supposed to exist. And what he was really talking about was gender bias in public policy, in social policy, in the law, in, you know, the criminal justice system, in family court, all of that. That was the second set of books that I'm sure he was talking about. And how there's just a huge anti-male bias in all of those areas in specific situations. So, yeah, he sent his manifesto to a newspaper. He self-immolated on the steps of the courthouse. And one thing that kind of surprised me was how angry so many people were about this. It was like, how dare you die, kill yourself in a way that makes us feel uncomfortable and have to think about things.
Right.
You know, how dare you do that, you monster. I mean, it's not like he wrote in his manifesto about we should be bombing courthouses and stuff like that and setting fire to police stations and the whole bit.
And I think he said to bomb the feminist place in Washington or something too, didn't he?
I'm sure he did, because they are the sort of the architects of the feminist movement is the architect of all of these laws and policies. They basically wrote the Violence Against Women Act, and they wrote the Duluth model of domestic violence, and they wrote all of these extremely biased, non-fact-based models for how society should be dealing with this stuff. And that all gets enacted into legislation. It all gets sort of shunted into public policy and police and arrest policy, things like that. So, of course, he's going to hold them accountable. But at the same time, he didn't take anybody out with him. He didn't go and take over and take hostages at this, you know, and start shooting people. He just did it in a way that embarrassed everybody.
Yeah.
And the reaction, especially from feminists, was, you know, and you men's rights people, you know, you think that he did, you know, he, by doing that in a public way and speaking out about it rather than just going off into a closet and cutting his wrists, you admire him. And it's like, so you're all monsters too, and you're all, you know, advocating violence, and oh my God, you know, because he died in an inconvenient way.
What do you find as some of the hypocrisy online between men's groups versus feminist groups?
Well, I'm not going to absolve men's groups of hypocrisy. There's a movement called masculism, and there are some pockets of that that seem to be just as woo-woo and non-evidence-based as feminism seems to be, very much an ism. And based on feelings and the world of should rather than the world of is. And so they don't get a free pass. They tend to be extremely hypocritical. The traditionalists in the men's rights movement, often, you know, there's a lot of infighting over that, because men don't want to be shunted into the traditional role again. It's burdensome. It's onerous. It's a lot of responsibility. You basically are responsible for everyone in your life. And basically, when you look at the Bible and everybody takes issue with the wife obey your husband passage, and then you look in the very next verse and it says, and if you are a man and you do not take care of your entire extended family, you're no longer a man. You have no virtue. Right? That's what traditionalism is. You know, wives obey your husband. Okay, now, husband, everything is your job. And most men don't really want that. The few traditionalists that I'm friendly with kind of see it as maybe it's really the only way society can function, which would really suck. And feminists, I mean, the hypocrisy, where do I start? You know, it, like, honestly, they women are powerful. Women are, you know, women are just as capable as a man. Women are strong. Women, you know, women kick ass, but women need extra social programs because they are uniquely harmed by every single thing in the world.
Right.
Right. The whole war on women right now, this big thing, you know, like it's eating up the entire public awareness as far as, you know, with the election. And all it is that in some situations, in a few situations, such as if a woman goes to a Catholic university or works for the Catholic Church, right, in some situations, they will be treated almost as poorly as all men are treated all the time under the health policies.
Yeah,
right?
So crazy.
Vasectomy is not covered. Tubal ligation is. Male birth control, they don't get free condoms, right? But, you know, if you can't if you aren't willing to force the Catholic Church to pay for somebody's birth control, you are an evil, evil person, and you're waging a war on women.
Oh, well, you know, and I know women all the time who go down to the county office and the county health office and get free birth control and everything that's paid for by the rest of us.
Yeah, well, it's paid for, you know, you can get it from a charity, you can get it subsidized, you can... when Sandra Fluke went up and testified, she was like, $3,000 over, you know, the course of law school is what women will have to pay for this birth control. And I'm thinking, you know, I was paying $20 a month and $8 of that was the pharmacy dispensing fee. So if I had gotten 6 months at a time, I could have saved $40.
Sure.
Off the 6 months worth, right? So, I mean, this is not breaking the bank. If you're attending law school, if you've got, you know, this huge student debt and you're paying for textbooks and you're paying for this and you're paying for that, and you're probably paying for some partying on the weekends, and then to bitch and moan because other people aren't going to pay for your $20 a month that is not even a health need because you can choose not to have sex.
Right.
And I'm almost positive that the Catholic university she attends doesn't hand out free condoms.
You know, and interestingly, the Catholic Church has been the most adamant proponent of natural birth control, which, you know, provides so much more freedom in relationships than this birth control stuff does anyway. If people just get informed on their bodies and their cycles, they can time that pretty exactly.
Well, I wouldn't go so far as to say that, that being that I come from a family that is cursed with something called super fecundity. I've often joked that if I borrow somebody's toothbrush, 2 weeks later, the line will be blue. You know, I have two sisters who both got pregnant at age 40 while using birth control. So,
wow.
Yeah. So, I mean, for some women, it's just not going to be adequate. I know it's never been adequate for any woman in my family on my mother's side. So, you know, there's that. But when you look at it and you think, well, you know, I not only have a choice to have sex, that's a lifestyle issue, it's not a health issue, that it's my choice to have sex. It is my choice what kind of sex I have. There are tons of things that you can do without risking reproducing, without risking getting pregnant. Aren't we supposed to be adventurous? Aren't we supposed to not see the penis and vagina sex as the be-all and end-all? You know, so, I mean, there are a lot of other things you can do if you can't afford that somewhere between $9 and $20 a month that you'd have to pay for birth control.
Right. I mean,
and saying that this is a war on women, it just makes me want to pick up all of those feminists and dump them in the middle of a war zone. This is what war looks like, ladies.
Yeah, it's really incredible, the hypocrisy.
Well, I mean, just the exaggeration and the hyperbole and the... It seems like the answer that they always come up with, or the way they always come up with to deal with these things, is basically by saying, you're injuring me, right? And the moment a woman says, you're injuring me, that's the end of the conversation.
Right.
So.
All right, so let's go into the differences between how some of these women groups are dealt with compared to, say, how some of the men's groups are dealt with. And I know you've done some videos on this about, you know, and some of these men have filed reports against the women hate groups and have had absolutely nothing done about it.
Oh, well, what I find hilarious is I actually had a feminist... contact me through a personal message and tell me that I was associating with misogynists and terrorists, and you know, who advocate violence against women. And I was kind of like, okay, well, I want to make sure that I'm not doing that. So could you please direct me to, you know, the blog posts in question or the comments in question, and you know, forward me the links. And she did, and it was insane because the conversation was basically, it was about the sort of the slogan that they had chosen at avoiceformen.com. And the slogan, or the sort of the motto, was fuck their shit up. Okay. And this woman had asked the guy who owns the site, Paul Elam, well, what is it? Are you going to walk away? Because we're talking about, we talk a lot about men going their own way, just walking away and refusing to participate. Are you going to walk away, or are you going to stay around and fuck their shit up? And he said, well, feminism needs men's taxes to fund all of this crap. So by walking away, we are fucking their shit up. And she took that to be a threat of violence, advocating violence and terrorism. This is her example.
By walking away. Wow.
You're going to walk away and not have full-time jobs and not be economic generators and not get married. That apparently is terrorism. Because I guess because they used the F word and the S word. Maybe, or just because it's a man and he's not happy. And whenever a man's not happy, everybody ducks and covers. And then we went, some people in the men's community went and dug up some really, really unbelievable stuff on a feminist website called Rad Fem Hub or Radical Hub. And some of it was just absolutely, and some of the contributors there are Julie Bindle, she's a noted feminist, Sheila Jeffries, she's a tenured professor at Melbourne University in Australia, and Kathy Brennan owns the site, she's an attorney, a best-selling author of legal thrillers, I think she publishes through Simon & Schuster, is a contributing author, and when they dug up the information on these people, they kind of went in their clandestine and dug up all of this, and they're fine. And people who are community coordinators and they work for chambers of commerce and they sit on arts councils and they are special educators for children. They're teachers. They're attorneys. They're lobbyists who have been instrumental in getting legislation passed. And these women are all discussing just these absolutely horrible things. And when one feminist took issue with the men's community online, and she had contacts within the Southern Poverty Law Center, and she sent them a letter, and their reaction to that letter about the misogyny and the hate and everything in the men's community online and the violence and all of that was to write an expose, three articles about how we're all misogynists and we promote hatred and we advocate violence and all of this. And one of the examples that they used was, you know, here's Paul Elam of A Voice for Men. Sorry, I'm affiliated with him, so I'm more familiar with this than with some of the other accusations they threw elsewhere. But he's advocating violence, and then they quote him as saying, you know, well, if you could hit a woman back, right, maybe women would think twice before they go around beating on men, right? That men should have the right to defend themselves when a woman is attacking them.
Sure.
Right?
Right.
And that if more men did this, maybe women would not feel like it's open season to hit men whenever they feel like it. And that was according to the SPLC advocating violence against women. And so Paul Elam, of course, drew their attention to this site, Radical Hub. And they looked into it, and then they phoned, I guess they phoned or emailed Kathy Brennan, who owns the site, and asked her if she hated men. And she said, well, of course I don't hate men. I have a father. I have a brother. I have a son. You know, don't be silly. And that's all it took for them to leave her alone. Right?
Wow.
I'm like, okay, Paul Elam has a mother and he has a sister. And, you know, so obviously he couldn't possibly be misogynist. Oh, wait, that doesn't work that way when we're talking about men, because we don't just take their word for it. We actually look into it. And we actually take what men say seriously, whereas it seems to be the attitude with these women at Radical Hub that, you know, oh, well, they're just venting. You know, they're just complaining.
Sure.
You know, like, what could they do? They're just women. I mean, oh, just pat them on the head and, you know, maybe they can eat some Ben and Jerry's.
Yeah, well, let's get into this topic of, you know, you mentioned earlier these women want to exterminate or commit eugenics against men. And in one of your videos, you read a lot of the quotes off of these sites, like, what is your video? Okay, I'm not a feminist or something like that.
Oh, no, that one is actually called Hate, with several exclamation points.
Okay.
Where I read a bunch of the quotes from the women specific to the Radical Hub website.
And go ahead.
Well, I mean, like, some of the stuff that they talk about, I mean, there was one article done by that author who writes for Simon & Schuster, where she actually says what's wrong with men is that their androgens need genetic modification. I'm serious about this. If we can do it with corn, men ought to be easy. That was the closing of her article. And the article talks about how, you know, men are basically genetically dysfunctional. There's something inherent to men that makes them the way she sees them, not the way they are, as far as I can tell, because men are generally pretty decent, but the way she sees them, which is like oppressive and horrible and violent and brutal and nasty and unpleasant and perverts and rapists. And so, I mean, some of the follow-up comments, I actually have them called up here. someone says, we must consider this, that men are biologically, genetically, mentally ill, and the only solution to this is a biological solution. And another one says, women need to stop raising male children. Nobody wants to bite that bullet except lesbian separatists, but it must be done. Oddly enough, her screen name is Mary Sunshine, so I don't know if you find that ironic.
Wow.
Another one with another ironic screen name, she says, the not raising male children is difficult for me as I have one. I mean, we need female children, and I'm so glad I have a daughter. She was my first. Perhaps I should have stopped at one. And her name's Cherry Blossom Life. I really pity her son. And then one of them made a comment such as, once the midwife hands the baby to the mother, it's up to her what she does with it. In other words, male infanticide would be fine. Let's see, even if we killed off 90% of the men, the majority of women left over would do their best to keep the oppressive system. I dare say we'd have to kill off all the women too and leave the little girls and the rad femmes to create the utopia. My vision, a world where mothers are in charge every step of the way, a world where males are shunned by everyone and punished severely.
Isn't that what we already live in?
Well, kind of, yeah. We're not quite, it's not quite good enough for these ladies. Actually, they should be put on a leash, put in a cage, or put to sleep, just like they do to any animal which causes them any problem. Let's see. That is how we will win, not birthing males. We have absolute power over reproduction, and the men know it, so that is our weapon. Someone else chimes in, actually, now that I think about it, a better source of animal glue, and leather for that matter, would be from the bodies of men who have committed any crime against a woman. They should be put to death, skinned, and then their carcasses can be boiled for glue. And she continues in the next comment, although I think we would be overrun and probably wouldn't have the resources to deal with all the bodies.
Wow,
so,
that's disgusting.
Yeah, it's really...
And the women groups get away with this stuff, and you're probably reading this right off of their website right now, I would suspect.
Well, it's from a file that I copied and pasted from screenshots that were taken at the website. So, I mean, and honestly, see, they're supposed to specialize in hate groups, and it seems to me that these women are a hate group, and in the article that spurred all of these comments, they're actually talking about what strategies can we, you know, engage in order to maybe see if we can find any sympathetic members of the scientific community to look into tainting the water supply with chemicals that will tame men's androgens, or, you know, we could get female gynecologists and obstetricians to perform sex selective abortions, and, you know, all kinds of stuff like that. You know, let's strategize and figure out if we can do this. And there was, you know, what they got from the SPLC was a big shrug. And
wow.
Oh, well, Kathy Brennan told us she didn't hate men, so it really is. It's infuriating. It seems like no matter how aggressive a woman is, she would literally have to beat somebody half to death with a baseball bat before we wonder if, okay, maybe she is serious. So
right.
We just don't see women. We don't see women as enacting violence. We don't view them in that way. So it can be extremely frustrating dealing with stuff like this.
How are women placed above men in patriarchal society?
Well, I think they're protected and they're provided for. That's the whole system. The whole system is a set of expectations, assumptions, and perceptions of women, and expectations, assumptions, and perceptions of men. And the entire purpose of the system is to basically to enable women to have external help in raising their kids. right? That they don't need to be all by themselves, with just and totally responsible for keeping themselves and their children alive. Somebody is going to help them with that. And of course, men want to help them with that because men want to pass on their genes just as much as the next guy. And so they basically found sort of an economic system, and it's one that's repeated in nature all over the place, where, you know, a man rents a woman's uterus. He rents that space by providing and protecting. That's the exchange. That's a transaction. So that was patriarchy. It was women, you have children. Men, you provide for and protect that woman and those children. And in exchange, we're going to give you some rights and entitlements and protections and all of this, depending on whether you're a man or a woman, depending on whether you are a husband or a wife. And there was general equilibrium that was going on through most of history that based on the harshness of the environment or the laxness of the environment, the amount of leisure and luxury and safety that was available would generally mean women were more free, and the more harsh and brutal things were out in the world, the less free women were. The expectation, though, has always been on men to do the protecting and to do the providing. So,
how can you relate that to Afghanistan and the level, you know, the role of women there?
Well, I mean, you look at life expectancies, and a boy in Brighton, born in Brighton in the UK, will die sooner than a woman, like a girl born in Afghanistan. And that's because women are protected. And that job, because they don't have, you know, a strong government, a big government, a robust police force, they don't have, they've just come out of 30 years of proxy war, and fought on their soil, and, you know, their entire country, their infrastructure, their economy, everything was just demolished. And basically, things were so horrible, things were so awful, people were starving, you know, men were dropping like flies, boys were dropping like flies, children were dying all over the place. The Taliban came in and said, well, we can fix this. You women, you stay home, stay safe. You men, you go out and risk bullets to bring resources back to her, and nobody better move from the box that we put you in.
Right.
And things were so bad in Afghanistan that people looked at that and thought, okay, well, it probably is going to suck, but it's a system that will work. So, and it's founded on protecting women and expecting them to play a part in their own protection by not going out without male accompaniment, and covering themselves up, and having basically no freedoms at all to direct their own lives. And men have lots of freedom, but they face all of the danger and the risk and all of the costs of the violence. As much as they can absorb all of that, so that women won't have to. So then,
I mean, you know, when you put it in that perspective, then how do we deal with the physical suppression of women under those circumstances? Or, I mean, I guess obviously if the women were out running the streets, then under the situation with us out over there trying to steal all of their lithium and everything for our cell phones, then, you know, then I suppose the women would be under that pressure instead of the men who are sacrificed, and none of that is ever even considered or factored into the scenario at all on any level that I've ever heard of until I heard your work.
Yeah.
Well, part of the problem is that when you look at a society like that, it's men who suffer almost all of the violence, but it's also men who perpetrate 99% of the violence. At least of the violence out there that we can see. And so it's almost like we want to just sort of turn them into a monolithic perpetrator class, where we assume that they are all inherently violent, that it's sort of like a victim-perpetrator equivalency game that we play. If a man is attacked by another man, it cancels it out. You can still blame it all on the man. we don't look at how the system benefits women and protects women. We only really look at, because our sexism against men is utilitarian, as long as they're being useful, then we don't pay attention to them. And when they're being harmful, we really pay attention to them. And then with women, it's any kind of way that we can lift burden off of women, we will try to do that. And the problem with feminist advocacy, as far as places like Afghanistan, and I know that they're extremely touchy about it because they don't want to be seen as Islamophobes, right?
Right.
They really don't want to be seen as, I guess, bigoted against anyone but men. But they try to reserve, you know, condemnation and judgment and all of that. You know, well, we can't understand like and all that. But at the same time, they still blame the men there for all the problems. What they think will work is if we elevate women, if we improve things for women, then the country will be better off. And unfortunately, that's not the case. Unless you're going to, like, you know, pick up a modern city and dump it in the middle of Afghanistan with all of the infrastructure and everything and the electricity and the hot and cold running water and all of that.
And keep U.S. and foreign interests from stealing their resources out. That would be the number one issue, I think.
That would be a huge thing. But, you know, unless you're prepared to actually advance them to the point where it would be like they're living in the Western world, those women are going to need their men to be okay. You cannot take a third world country and only help the women and expect that the society that you make out of that is going to be healthy.
You know what? I'm just going to throw out a joke right here, and I really apologize, but is it any irony that the lithium for the women's vibrators comes from Afghanistan?
Oh, well, I have people saying, like, I was in a discussion online just the other day where, you know, the guy was like laying out all of the, you know, it's men's competitiveness and that has led to, you know, all of these wars and all of this hardship and depleting the resources and going in and invading these third world countries and stripping them of their resources and oppressing their people and colonizing, and it's all the men. And he figures that because women have a maternal instinct that they would be better leaders. And I'm like, well, okay, number one, women are no less violent and no less competitive than men. They just exercise their violence by proxy so that they don't have to face the risks inherent of, you know, enacting your own competition and violence, right? When you go up and you attack somebody, you run the risk of being killed, right? So you convince somebody else to do that for you. That's how, generally how women have always operated, and it's understandable.
I'll love you forever if you go kill that guy for me.
That's right. But even aside from that, and the insane moral hazard involved in, say, putting an entire military full of men in the hands of somebody who's never had to experience violence, just would never ever be expected to be a soldier, would never ever be exposed to that kind of thing, and she knows it, right? And to put an entire military in the hands of somebody who would never be called on to serve their country in that way, that's iffy to begin with. But that women's competitiveness and violence is actually intimately tied to their maternal instinct, right? Women drive consumption. Women generate 80% of consumer spending.
What you're saying is that all of the competition that the men go out and do is to supply the women.
Pretty much. I mean, you look at the market share for personal items is 70% or more of personal items sold are for women. It's maybe not women buying them, but they're being bought for women. When you look at the amount of control that they have over consumer spending, it's at least 80%. Even when you look at I read, oh, I forget where, I wish I should probably save, go back and look for the link, but when you have a traditional relationship with a man and a woman, and the man is the breadwinner and the woman is the stay-at-home spouse, then financial decisions are shared roughly equally. But when you have a woman who is the breadwinner and a man who is a stay-at-home spouse, women control the majority of the spending and the financial decisions. So you're looking at, when feminists look at economic power, and they're always, you know, the wage gap, the wage gap, the wage gap, and they never tend to want to look at, okay, but women have a lot of spending power. They have a lot of spending power in that they have plenty of money that they decide what it gets spent on. And that's not just groceries and laundry detergent, that's houses and cars. And they command the greatest share of consumption. They drive consumption.
And don't you also show that women actually have about a 10% higher pay rate than men when everything is factored evenly?
Well, when everything's factored, well, not when everything's factored evenly. Right now, when women are under 30 and they don't have children, so unmarried childless women in the U.S. earn 8% more than unmarried childless men. And that is an actual true wage gap. That is, well, it's the same wage gap that feminists claim works the other way. It's basically they take the average of all the incomes of all of the people who are working full time, and they decide, they find that women earn 8% more. And that certainly could be the result of the fact that women are 60% of university graduates. They're the majority of people who have high school diplomas. So
why do you think men are dropping out of universities? Because they used to be the majority.
A lot of it has to do with activism. A lot of it has to do with the fact that there was a push for toward parity in education for women. A lot of policies were brought in, a lot of changes in teaching methods, and things like women-only funding and scholarships and bursaries and grants and all of that. And so now what we have is we have sort of some faculties are 80% women, right? And then we have like one or two, I think it's business and STEM, science, technology, engineering, and math, right, that are still dominated by men, right? But everything else is at least 50% or more women, 50 to 80% women. And what we have is we have nobody kind of going, well, maybe we need to encourage, bring in some measures and some policy changes and some, you know, incentives and stuff to get men to enroll in this faculty that's 80% women. No, we see that as actually more equality. But we do have Obama recently saying he wanted to expand Title IX, which is part of the Office of Equal Opportunity, I think, in the Department of Education. Expand Title IX into the STEM fields so that we could get parity for women in those fields. So it's basically the last place that men still outnumber women in education, and we can't have that. That is not equality. 80% women in, say, psychology, right? That's equality. But, you know, 80% men in STEM fields, that's bad. So, I mean, you really have, even still, even now, and men and women had parity in post-secondary education as far as enrollment went. Back in 1982 was when they met in the middle, and it was 50-50. And ever since then, it's just been diverging. And it seems like university is just becoming sort of hostile ground for men, even when you consider that, you know, there's women who are like, well, there's no one here to date, and men would, you know, you would think logically say, well, I can get all the free sex I want because it's a buyer's market, right? You know, for you know, but you don't have men saying that, right? You really don't, because it's not a environment anymore that's conducive to men. It's kind of steeped in male original sin, and, you know, every man is a potential rapist, and the sort of the the female, the women's center on campus is sort of the they rule the roost. And there's all kinds of bizarre things that they do now. They do this thing with the clothesline where they have T-shirts hanging and slogans written on the T-shirts like "She fears you" or you know, "She you don't, you're not allowed to beat her" and stuff like that. "She's scared of you. You're a brutal man," right? "Don't be an abuser," right? And men have to walk through these clotheslines full of these shirts on their orientation day. Right. Wow. So these are men who may have done nothing wrong, never even hit their little sister in their whole lives. And they're made to do this to kind of heap, you know, sort of male guilt on them. You know, they almost feel like they have to apologize for being a man.
Yeah.
So and you can't live your life in a state of apology and have any kind of enjoyment. So.
You know, I saw this documentary film last year. This male student went around and was asking where the male departments were and the men's studies were and things like this, and getting thrown out of places and stuff just for even asking.
Mm-hmm. Oh, well, we have at Simon Fraser University in BC. I'm Canadian, by the way, eh? And...
Well, that has got to be why you're doing this, because, you know, anybody north of whatever that latitude line is, you know, I don't know.
No, we're even worse than you guys in some ways, as far as this stuff goes. But,
oh, yeah. And you guys have all of the stuff that Kevin Annette has been revealing, too. Well, and we've got that here with the Indian schools and killing all of the native kids.
Well, it's just, you know, honestly, it's how early can we get them into the program? You know, into programming, right? So it's kind of frustrating for me because they're trying to move it back younger and younger and younger, like talking about starting mandatory schooling at age 2 in Ontario.
Wow.
And that just seems insane to me.
But
I was going to say, actually, though, Simon Fraser University recently, they allocated $30,000. They had a budget surplus, and they allocated $30,000 towards a men's center on campus. And the flack they got for that, they basically said, "Here's $30,000, which is how much we give to the women's center on campus, and there are some issues that men would probably really like to sit down and discuss amongst themselves." And some of the students at the university made this YouTube video where they're talking about, like, all it's going to be is just a bunch of douchebags sitting around playing PS3 and making rape jokes and stuff like that. So, I mean, the idea is that, okay, well, men don't have issues and men don't have problems. They're privileged. And, okay, even if they have issues and problems, they should not be given a space to discuss them amongst themselves because Lord only knows what they'd be doing.
They would be plotting against the women.
Yeah. You know, you know, and then I look and I see Radical Hub, right, which is a closed forum. You know, somebody actually went in there, sneaky, and sort of basically went in there incognito and took screenshots of all of this and did all of this investigation, right? And I'm thinking, this is a group of women who are plotting against men, right?
Yeah.
And then... whenever they say, well, if men are together, they're plotting against, like, is this projection much? Like, so, I don't know.
Right.
But, there you go.
Getting back to the issue of Muslims and Islam, what do Muslims have to say about your work?
I've actually had a few. One of them, he wrote me and he said that one thing that's always really upset him when, you know, he's sort of walking down the street and he lives in either the United States or Canada, I forget, and he says people look at him in this sort of way that, you know, you're a Muslim, you brutalize women. That's what you do. And he found it extremely upsetting because at least in his extended family, and it's not like they've been for generations upon generations. But in his extended family, I mean, he loves his sisters and he loves his mother, and he treats them like princesses, and they're very much pedestalized and taken care of and protected and all of that. And I'm sure maybe to some of those women that might get overbearing at times, but it's sort of all well-intentioned. At least according to him, and he just finds it extremely unfair to be looked at in that way. He finds it, he just thinks it's just not, it's unfair. You know, he feels guilty, and he doesn't feel like he should have to feel guilty.
Now, let me ask you this. In countries like India, when the father, head of the household, died, the women were put to death with that person. How would you explain that under your research?
Well, that phenomenon was often voluntary. It wasn't always required. And so a lot of women kind of threw themselves on the pyre. And the odd thing is that what we don't tend to hear about is that a lot of men would throw themselves on the pyre. If there was a man who was a servant who was very close with his employer, or, you know, somebody who just felt a very deep bond with this person, he would throw himself on the fire too. So, I mean, this is, it's messed up, but I think a lot of it, we don't hear about a lot of it. It's like with the acid attacks. You constantly hear about men who throw acid in women's faces in places like Bangladesh and India and Cambodia. But what you don't tend to hear is that 30% of the victims of acid attacks in 2010, and there were only 115 reported incidents worldwide in 2010. But 30% of the victims, thank you, were men. And most of the men were attacked by women. And then you realize, when you look into it a little deeper, that a fair amount of the attacks on women were perpetrated by other women, you know, out of jealousy. You stay away from my husband. You're young and beautiful. Well, I'll show you. So, I mean, it really is not. We want to see these things as simple. We want to be able to just say, okay, women are good and they're victims, and men are bad and they're perpetrators. But it's not like that. It's more complex. It's not simple like that. So,
one thing that there's definitely, you know, myself included, is confusion about feminism. Just having a rough idea of what feminism is, and confusing it with gender equality as like synonyms. And from your work, I've gotten clearer and clearer that that is not the case. So what is the difference between gender equality and feminism?
Well, feminism is advancement of women's interests. And they, you know, a lot of them, I really feel like they are pro-equality, and that this is the right way to achieve it. Because they're starting from a false assumption. You know, they're starting from the wrong starting point. But, you know, feminism is an extremely difficult thing to pin down. Somebody I was talking to said something along the lines of, you know, fighting feminism is like trying to sword fight with a fart. Right? Like, it's you can't do it. I mean, you know, you talk about feminist theory and oh, well, that's not liberal feminism. That's sex negative feminism, or that's second wave feminism, or that's radical feminism, or that's this feminism, or that feminism, or the other feminism.
Or, but here's the big point. They're all feminism.
Yeah, and they all generally, like, I don't think that I've ever met one that didn't buy into things like patriarchy theory, rape culture, systemic gendered violence against women, patriarchal terrorist paradigm of domestic violence, male privilege, and historic female oppression. I've never actually, you know, and it's so frustrating, because I wish we could get away from calling things privilege and oppression. Even if we're counting on both sides of the gender debate having some privilege and some oppression that they're dealing with, I really wish we could just move on to basically saying expectations, assumptions, and perceptions. this that apply to either gender. Just sort of disarm the language, you know, take the value judgment out of it, out of how you label things. Because when you're dealing with a problem that's basically perpetuated by all of society, including the women, right, and it's extremely hard to pinpoint blame. I mean, things are, they're just the way, we just see things the way we see things. We just have these expectations because we do, because that's what's worked all through our history. That was the system that worked best, that that produced the most babies, that survived the longest, right? So, I mean, when you look at the loaded language of feminism, you know, where they're talking rape culture, you know, like, can you get any more loaded than that? You know, and then when you look into it and you realize that it's patently false and it's never been true, at least not as it applies, as they apply it to women, you know, you sort of like, you realize that, and then nobody will admit it. Nobody, well, I don't believe in that. You know, I'm this kind of feminist. And I'm just like, oh my God, you make me want to put my head in my hands. It's like, it literally is. It's like trying to have a fist fight with a swarm of gnats.
Right.
You know, like, because you cannot, like, no matter how you decide that you're going to define feminism, well, but there are no feminists that are like that. You're fighting a straw man. You're, oh my God, it's just.
So what about the feminists? What about the number of abused women compared to the number of abused men? Don't the numbers clearly show men as the abusers?
The numbers clearly show that men and women, that about 50% of domestic violence that occurs, and this is, you know, all over the world, not this would be as likely to happen in a place like India as in Canada. 50% of domestic violence involves two people who hit each other. And women instigate the hitting at least half the time. And they've also found that anywhere from 50 to 70% of what's called non-reciprocal, unilateral, severe domestic violence. So that's like one partner being extremely violent with a non-violent partner. Anywhere from 50 to 70% of that is perpetrated by women. So, I mean, like, there's one woman wrote a book about, basically about how we don't want to look at the level of violence in lesbian relationships.
What's the book called?
Is the moment I forget what it's called. It's got secret or something in the title. But it, she basically says, we don't want to look at the level of violence in lesbian relationships because it's really uncomfortable to realize that women can behave that way. And there's no way to not see it when it's two women.
Right. It's very easy. No man to blame.
It's very easy to ignore it or to justify it when it's a woman hitting a man, and you instantly in your head, it's like, well, I bet he was cheating on her, or I wonder what he did to deserve that, right? And you just sort of excuse it. But when a woman is beating on another woman, it's harder to do that. And so nobody wants to examine that, least of all feminists. So, because it would just put the kibosh on all of their theories. So,
are there any systems in place to help abused men and or boys?
Not really. I mean, like, there are some men that I've talked to who did go to domestic violence shelters and said that that was the most helpful place there was. They did not give him a bed. They did not give him a hotel voucher. But at least they called what he was experiencing abuse, right? But generally, at least more than half the time, when a man phones a domestic violence hotline to report that he's a victim of a woman, he will be referred to batterer treatment programs rather than to victim services. There are no victim services that I know of in Canada for men. I know there's a...
So they're automatically considered the committer of the violence, the batterer, and they're sent to that?
Yes. Well, and the insane thing is like, so... all of our policy and all of our legal policy and all of our public services and all of that that the government funds, they're all based on something called the Duluth model of domestic violence. And when you go to the Duluth website and you go to their FAQ, section. And one of the things that I just found hilarious was, you know, somebody like the frequently asked question, is the Duluth model evidence-based? And the answer on the website is, the Duluth model is the most widely used domestic violence model, domestic violence prevention model in the world.
So it was an appeal to popularity, not an answer of the question itself.
It doesn't even answer the question, and because it can't without lying, right?
Wow.
It's really not evidence-based. Like I said, you know, early feminists, they asked the right questions, they just didn't ask all of them. And so the earliest research that they did into domestic violence involved police reports, conviction rates, and then on top of that, they would do surveys and they would ask men only about their perpetration and women only about their victimization. And so, I mean, when you don't ask all the questions, you're going to get a skewed view. And of course, out of this, you know, arrest rates, conviction rates, and only asking men and women certain questions, you're going to find a preponderance of male perpetrators and female victims. And it was hilarious because Murray Strauss, who's sort of extremely well known in the men's rights community, he decided, because he was a staunch feminist, he decided he was going to do an unbiased, I am going to answer these charges. I am going to do an unbiased study, a survey on domestic violence, and I will prove to them that it is male perpetrated, that it is a problem of male violence. And he was shocked by his own results. He was like, I had no idea. And then he was further shocked by the tactics that were used to try and suppress and dismiss and just basically make him go away and try and blacklist him. And then he, you know, when you look at Aaron Pitsey, who opened the world's first domestic violence shelter in the UK in, I think, 1971, she found that out of her first 100 clients, 63 or 64 of them were as violent as or more violent than the men that they were running away from. And so she decided she was going to open a shelter for men, right? And by that point, her shelter movement had been sort of, the second wave feminists had sort of gotten into it and sort of taken it over, volunteered their way in until they outnumbered her. And she ended up sort of being shoved aside, displaced out of her shelter movement. And when she would go and try to do speaking engagements on domestic violence, how it's not just a female victim problem, they would call in bomb threats. They sent her death threats. They threatened to kill her and her children and her grandchildren. Eventually, she was living under police protection. And under that police protection, they couldn't get to her, so then they killed her dog, and that's when she left the country and went into hiding for 10 years.
Wow.
So, yeah, it's honestly, it's hilarious because, you know, it's almost like, how dare you say women are violent? If you ever say that again, we're going to, we're going to kill your dog.
Indeed.
You know, so, I mean, it doesn't even make sense, but, you know, this is really the way the way they've tried to suppress this information. I mean, like, we're talking, you know, 180 minimum actual surveys and then several analyses and examinations and other papers written based on those surveys, you know, around the world. Stats Canada says that 7% of women in Canada have been a victim of domestic violence and 6% of men have, you know. So, I mean, even government statistical bodies, you know, research, statistic gathering bodies cannot say, well, it's a male perpetrated problem. It's,
right.
It's, there's parity. So, but all of our law, all of our legislation, all of our policies are all based on it being a male crime against women. And, I remember reading an analysis of what happened when feminists managed to get mandatory arrest policies sort of enacted as policy back in the 80s. And in California, those mandatory arrest policies resulted in a 37% increase in arrests of men and a 446% increase in arrests of women. And shortly after that, feminists decided that they were going to do a predominant aggressor policy. And the predominant aggressor policy is what's in use today in most police departments. And basically, the cop has to say who's bigger, who's stronger, who's heavy, who could do the most damage, who's more distraught, which is almost always the woman is going to be the one who appears to be more distraught. And what are the acceptable models of domestic violence that we work from? Oh, well, that would be the Duluth model based on patriarchal terrorism. So there you go. And bang, arrest rates went all the way back to normal. So you're looking at battered men who are being arrested.
It's mind-boggling.
It's extremely, extremely frustrating. And then you still get people saying, well, but men are bigger and they are stronger and men should be able to protect themselves and they should be able to. And I'm thinking, you know, honestly, I've heard stories. The one guy, his wife tried to stab him in the neck in front of their kids, drew blood, went after him a second time, and he gave her a punch to the mouth, gave her a fat lip. And the cops came. She automatically just burst into tears after that. And went and phoned the police. The cops came and they were dragging him out of the house in handcuffs before his kids finally managed to convey what had happened. And the moment that they realized that, okay, this woman attacked him with a knife and he actually is bleeding from the neck from it. And yeah, okay, well, he was defending himself. Instead of arresting her, they said, get her to counseling, and left.
Wow.
So all of a sudden, this crime that they were going to charge him with turned into a mental health issue that she needs help for, right? She doesn't need punishment or prevention. She needs help.
So where do you think women get this sense of entitlement?
I think women have always had it. I think they've always needed it. Honestly, when you look at what led women to survive and pass on their genes, it was expecting that certain things be done for them. You know, somebody else carry the heavy boxes, somebody else face the dangers, somebody else, you know, do all of those difficult, dangerous things. Because if a woman didn't expect that, then she didn't pass on her genes, right? Or if she did, her children didn't survive. And men have always felt obligated to provide for that sense of entitlement. I think that what we see as entitlement now is different, because there's just so many more things to want and expect now.
Right.
It used to be that it was only really possible to feel entitled to a husband who would go out and drag his ass to the coal mine every day and come home and be happy with the supper that I put on the table and expect me to mend his shirts, right? I feel entitled to a man who's prepared to do that so that I can do my job, right? But now they're just so many different things to want. There are so many different things to consume. There's so much credit that we end up having that banks want to give us. So there's just so much more things we could buy. And, you know, honestly, the sense of entitlement that scarcity kept in check is just, it's totally ballooned. And then the fact that women don't really have to do things that they don't want to anymore. And because we as a society want to protect women and we don't want to see them starve because they made mistakes or because they made bad decisions, right? We are prepared to, as much as we can afford, bail them out of their mistakes and protect them from consequences. And so the more we do that, the more entitled women become. And I mean, like, honestly, men have become more entitled too, but I don't think at the rate that women have. I was reading a book called The Narcissism Epidemic, Living in the Age of Entitlement, and women have been the fastest growing demographic of people who actually have enough psychological markers to qualify as having narcissistic personality disorder. And I do think that the culture feeds that.
Yeah, absolutely.
Well, you can have anything. You know, you can have it all. They didn't say, feminists didn't say, you can do it all. Right? They could say you can do anything, but they never said you can do it all. Do it all. I mean, how scary would that be? Oh, you just do everything. Right? No, they said you can have it all. So, you know, you can do anything and you can...
The right to an iPhone.
It's like, my kids, they're happy with $20 sneakers and a bus pass. None of them own an iPhone. Like, none of them own a cell phone. And I asked my son, as a joke, I got him a lawnmower for his 18th birthday. First, then I'm like, Jack, come see your birthday present. And he comes running up the stairs all excited, and I like, behold. And he's like, yeah, thanks, Mom. Welcome to adulthood. You're kicked out.
That's funny. So let's get into the women in the military issue. What are your feelings about that, and what issues are caused by feminism in the military?
Well, one of the things that I have found in any kind of women going into a male profession or a male field or a male endeavor is that if you are competent, if you can cut it, you actually get extra respect. It's like when I go to Home Depot with my extremely large, burly boyfriend and they come up to him and they automatically talk to him. Right. And this doesn't bug me because, like, statistically, of course, they're going to talk to him. And he says, I don't know. It's her project. And then I start talking about drywall and studs and 16 inches on center and, you know, how big the screws that I need. And, you know, I need drywall mud and I need a sander and I need ceiling tiles and I need light fixtures that fit in the ceiling tiles. And I need this, that and the other thing. And as soon as those men know that I know what I'm talking about, it's almost like they're, wow, I'm jazzed. A woman... She's completely competent at this. And I think that goes in engineering and any of those STEM fields. If a woman is actually as competent as the men there, they want her around.
Well, you know, I think it's part of the men's mating ritual in some way, because men like a woman that has as much in common as they do if they're not threatened by intelligent women. So a competent woman in their own field would typically be exciting.
Well, yeah, and I think there's a huge sort of misattribution of that sort of if you're not intimidated by intelligent women. I think that a lot of women like to think that men are intimidated by, you know, strong women, or they're intimidated by intelligent women. But a lot of the times men just don't like being around bitchy women and know-it-all women. Kind of, you know, I'm sure that there are some men who out there who are intimidated by strong or intelligent women, but I think that that gets overplayed a lot. And when you think about the military, it seems to me, just talking with men who have been soldiers, I've had a fair number of veterans get a hold of me and thank me and talk to me about their experiences. And the consensus seems to be among them that if they had to pass the same standards, if they had to put in the same amount of work, if they could carry the same amount of weight, then by all means, you're with us. You're one of the bros. And but in the military, I mean, who was it? Someone, he does YouTube videos under the name Man Woman Myth. And he says, you know, people, these female soldiers who are defending our freedom, right, with machine guns, and they're allowed to do push-ups on their knees.
Wow.
So, you know, honestly, and they still have the same opportunities for promotion. They still have the same opportunities for being in command. They don't see combat. They're not put in combat. And when you look at 17% of the U.S. military is female as far as soldiers go, not just support and administration staff, but soldiers. 17% of the soldiers in the military are women, and only 2% of the deaths are the women. So these are women who are not being put on the front lines. And for a reason, because they would not survive there. They would not be able to do it. And I've read an article by a female Marine who said that within something like 4 years of being a Marine, her body started to fall apart. She just, her body was not, her bone mass, her tendons, her muscle mass was not prepared to deal with that kind of intensity for that length of time. And now she's got permanent health problems. And maybe we have taken this whole women can do anything just a bit too far. Maybe we have to admit that we are not the same as men. So, and when you look at too, you know, you're going to have men protecting women. Men are going to be protecting women more, female soldiers more than they would protect male soldiers. So it does, and this, you know, you're going to say, well, it's a male problem. Well, yes and no. Right, because the culture certainly does everything it can to reinforce that mindset in men. You know, public service ad from Obama and company about how men, it's called One is Too Many. And, you know, if you see a woman being threatened, you know, step up, man up, intervene, right? Put your own safety on the line for her. So you really see the culture reinforcing that, and men can't help but feel protective of women in those kinds of situations. So,
what are some of the political ramifications of feminism?
Well, I mean, the issue with feminism and gender issues and gender politics is that they really they express in every aspect of life. You're talking about half the population and how they interact with the other half of the population and how the entire system works. What seems to be the case is that one of the biggest things that I see coming down the pike is that we're going to try and continue to bend over backwards and give women every single freedom we can, every single available choice that they could possibly have at as little cost to the individual woman making it as possible. And somebody has to pay for all that. And feminism does not want women to have to pay for that. Feminism wants a woman to be able to go to med school and spend $500,000 of public money to get her training and then drop out of the workforce a year later if that's what she chooses. So, you know, you look at what happens when you basically make half of the population into free agents who owe nothing to anything other than self-fulfillment and anything other than what they want to do at any given moment. And somebody has to make up for that. You have to have a larger police force. You have to have all kinds of systems in place in court to deal with all of the legal fallout and the criminal fallout and everything else. You have to have more money going to universities because tuition doesn't even begin to cover it anymore but where's the money going to come from? It has to come from tax revenue. Well, women don't tend to stay in the workforce as much and they don't earn as much over their lifetime, so they don't pay as much tax. So more of the tax burden goes on to men who are then handicapped in their ability to earn by not having as accessible an education. And, you know, so basically we're just driving the entire system into the ground economically, politically, socially, all of that. And it's not going to end in a happy place. It really, when the money runs out and the goodwill of men runs out, right? When the willingness of men to participate in the system and keep trying to be what women want and need them to be, when that runs out, when chivalry is expended, when it's gone completely, you know, there's going to be a rude awakening for all of us. So this is really what I'm hoping to head off at the pass, being that my kids are, you know, preteen and teenage, and they're going to have to live in this mess. So
what do you think the impact of feminism has been on the family?
Well, second wave feminists basically set out to destroy the family. They weren't circumspect about it. They weren't they didn't hide their intentions. Some of them have said things like the number one obstacle to women's liberation is marriage. We must destroy marriage, you know, destroy the nuclear family. Women are wasting their lives having children. I always found that one kind of humorous because feminists today, the third wavers, will say patriarchy was a system that devalued motherhood, right? Patriarchy was a system that thought women should have babies as much as possible and they should be helped and assisted and facilitated in that by individual men, right? And feminism was the one that came along and said you're wasting your life having children. So who actually devalued motherhood, right?
Right.
Like, because motherhood in the 1850s didn't come with a pay stub and a tax bill, what? Right? Is that why it wasn't valued? I mean, a man came home from wherever it was he worked, and most jobs were horrible back then. He came home from wherever it was he worked, and he shared his income that he had earned through his blood and sweat, right, with a woman so that their children, you know, and he paid out of his own labors, right? But he wasn't respecting motherhood. But yeah, I don't know. The whole worldview is screwed.
Yeah. Have you ever heard of the Celebrating Men, Satisfying Women material by Alison Armstrong?
I have not, actually. If you want to sort of explain the gist of it?
Well, it's the first, other than your work, it's the first, it's a course I did a number of years ago. She has a couple courses, but it's just about, she goes into kind of the differences of men and women and how, basically how the general way that women relate to men in our culture is like that men are misbehaving women. You know, and so she goes into her, in her work goes into like the ways that men are awesome that aren't like us and just, you know, tips and tricks in relationships. But I was just curious if you had were familiar with her stuff.
But I actually, her title or her premise, her sort of soundbite there reminds me of Tim Golditch. He's a NCFM member, National Coalition for Men member. And he wrote a book called, I think it was called Loving Men, Respecting Women. And his premise is that to the feminine, give nothing but compassion and love without respect. And to men, we give nothing but respect without passion and without compassion or love. Right? And that kind of is a little bit, and his sort of theory is that it all evens out. And I guess it used to back when being a husband and father was a respected role because it was really necessary and really important to women. When a man was literally a life support system for a woman and her children, right? It was an extremely respected role, especially since it cost men so much in terms of, you know, they would probably be able to be a bachelor and only expend 30% of what it took to be a family man in as far as energy goes. And so it was an extremely respected role. And now, you know, when I was discussing it with him, and I'm like, it doesn't even out anymore. Men don't get respect for those things. They don't get respect for much of anything. So, you know, we want to give women all the respect. We want to give them compassion. We want to give them love. We demand that they have unconditional respect. And the whole system's just kind of going towards just not caring about men.
Are you still there at all? Is that what you said?
We could afford to, right now, in this society, with this amount of leisure time and this amount of prosperity and this amount of wealth, we could afford to care about men now in a way that we never have before, right? But we don't. We care about them less because we're not dependent on them on an individual basis. So
did, in your opinion, did feminism create patriarchy?
Well, they they didn't create patriarchy. I think feminism and patriarchy, or at least the old system and how it worked. What have I said in the past? Feminism is paternalism in lipstick. So, I mean, it really is no different than the old system, than traditionalism. The traditionalism was a stern father that had expectations of all his children. Feminism seems to be a permissive father that blames his son for all of his daughter's mistakes and bails her out of all of her bad choices and gives her candy even when she's bad. So, you know, it's not that different. Did feminism invent patriarchy theory? I wouldn't say they invented it out of whole cloth. I know I've said that before. I know that there are bits and pieces of truth in it, but those bits and pieces are missing probably 80% of the entire picture. So, you know, feminists don't seem to have a good handle on how things work. And why they work the way they do, and really any kind of cure they propose to fix the problem of what's wrong with society and men and women and their positions in it, it's going to be like slapping a Band-Aid on skin cancer. So,
how does patriarchy hurt men as well?
Well, patriarchy is a system wherein men are expected to deprioritize their health, their well-being, and their safety for women and children. So, patriarchy is pistols at dawn because a woman's honor was insulted. Patriarchy is the man who drags his ass out of bed every day before sunup to go run a plow behind an ox while his wife does lighter duty at home. She still had things a lot more difficult than a woman does now, but she certainly had lighter duty than he did. Patriarchy was a system that removed as many burdens from women as it possibly could in order that women would be facilitated in having children. So, I mean, it really is... That's really what it is. It's an expectation on men to put women and children's well-being before their own.
So then are we men the problem? And let me just end with that. Are we men the problem?
Well, men are definitely at least half the problem. You see someone like Joe Biden, who is a staunch proponent of VAWA, like the Violence Against Women Act, and I was listening to him or reading an article that he had written where he says that when he was growing up, his sisters used to pound on him. He was never allowed to hit them back. That was just something that you do not do. Boys do not hit girls. And his sisters basically battered him. And now he's turned into somebody who is wanting to have legislation renewed that puts battered men in jail, right? He is definitely part of the problem. Obama is part of the problem. Obama prioritizes interests. Obama is very much interested in catering to women. Male politicians seem to see men as competitors to be kept out of the game if possible, and women as a demographic to court. So, I mean, it really is that if there's any possible way for a male politician to seem pro-woman, he will do it. And
So, you know, so men are willing to throw each other under the bus to support the women and these agendas.
Well, I mean, look at our roles through all of human history, all the way back to, like, way back to the beginning, right? Millions of years ago, even. The role of men was literally to compete with other males for a shot at the reproductive target and occasionally to bash other men's brains out to protect women and children. Now, how have ever performed that role if they said to them, if they had a psychological mechanism, a built-in mechanism similar to the one women have, where they would just automatically side with men, automatically help men, automatically, you know, just based on maleness, just based on, you're a man, you're my bro, I'm going to help you out. Like, they would never have been, the men who were like that didn't survive. They didn't survive to pass on their genes.
Right.
The women who are like that, who automatically prefer women, very much did. And they've shown in study after study after study that women have an automatic own group preference. Most of them show that at least 3/4 of the time, men will prefer women to other men. They will side with women rather than other men. You know, so, I mean, you're looking at a system that even when it was all men in charge was still skewed in women's favor.
So, in what other ways do women have control over men's identity and masculinity, and how have they created a system that, frankly, that they complain about?
Well, it's not necessarily that they created the system. It's they're not solely responsible for creating.
Well, okay, granted. I mean, you know, you have the Bidens or the Obamas and the people that put these laws. But what about us that don't believe in the false appeal to government authority in the first place, and it's still put on the rest of us? You know,
The system itself, the interactions between male and female psychology, all of that, it all evolved together, right? Our collective views of what men are like and what women are like, however skewed they are. Women's psychology, men's psychology, and how that interacts. It really is an interaction. I don't even know that you can say anybody created it. It evolved. And so it generally evolved largely through women's choices, women opting for the best deal that they could get, at the least, at the smallest cost, as far as the economic contract of marriage. And so, I mean, you're looking at a system that perpetuates itself. It's really hard to pin blame on anyone. Women definitely have had a huge hand in enforcing it. When you look at what would be considered drawing room decor, drawing room courtesy, that lowest common denominator of what is acceptable speech, what is acceptable interaction, that's all based on women's comfort level. It always has been. And women used to have a variety of ways that they enforced that. And it was almost never directly. It was always, oh, I'm shocked. You know, bring me my smelling salts. And then some men go and pound the crap out of the man who had offended her. So, I mean, it really is sort of an appeal to male agency. It's an appeal to the man's physical strength and protective instincts. Even when you look at the way we look as adult human beings, there's something called neoteny, and it basically means retention of childlike physical features. And women have that to a much greater degree than men do, because we don't want women who felt protective of men, right, because they had childlike features into adulthood, they didn't live very, very long, right? If a woman was going to stand in between a man and a charging rhino or whatever to protect him, it doesn't work in the evolutionary paradigm. Whereas when it works the other way, women who appear to be childlike, who have softer facial features, higher foreheads, smaller noses, larger eyes, softer mouths, not so strong a jaw, softer bodies, right? When you look at all of that and how people feel protective of children, partly because of the way children look, and people also feel protective of women partly because of the way women look. And when women add behavior to that, as I said, you're injuring me, you know, and then that's the end of the conversation. because nobody wants to be seen as injuring somebody who is, you know, helpless and needs protecting. So, I mean, these are the ways that women have enforced that. Women have always been able to say, like, you know, if you don't meet these expectations, if you don't fulfill these expectations of masculinity, then you are not a real man. My legs slam shut.
Indeed. All right, what is the single most important concept that you would like people to take away from this interview?
Oh, I don't know whether there's a single one. I guess maybe the one that always seems to get to me when I'm talking about these issues is that you really need to ask the right questions, or ask all the questions. I remember there's a study, I think I actually speak to it, on sex differences in personality and how the same data met for years had shown that there were very, very little sex difference in personality, very, very little difference between men and women in personality. And then when they fed all those numbers into a different mathematical model, into a different way of analyzing the data, they came up with a 10% overlap, and 90% of it was distinct male or distinct female. And that's all a matter of confirmation bias. I want to prove that men and women have very little difference in personality, so I'm going to categorize things, and I'm going to use a hierarchy of categorization and measurement that amalgamates all of these extreme differences that show up in all of these little, sort of at the bottom of the pyramid, right? And by the time they get to the top and the numbers all get combined, it shows very little difference, right? So I think, honestly, empiricism and intellectual rigor and really reading studies, not just looking at the headlines and the conclusions.
Oh, geez, I couldn't agree with you any more on that one.
Click on a link or search on Google Scholar and find the study, not just the abstract. Don't trust what people, you know, if people only publish the results and they don't publish the data, don't trust that. You know, you need the numbers too. You need to look at them. So, I mean, it really is a matter of really, really digging right in there, getting your hands dirty. So, not just taking people's word for things. That would be, I think, the big, because honestly, when you look at what we're doing as a society and what we're basing those decisions on, we are headed in a really bad direction. So we're going down the garden path.
All right, Karen, what are your websites? What's your radio show, and anything else that people interested in this issue can study?
Well, I vlog on YouTube under the username Girl Writes What. It's all one word, all small letters. If you type it into the search thing, it'll pop up right away. And I blog at owningyourshit.blogspot.com, which is, it's all, again, owning your shit, all one word, all lowercase. I do a radio show every Thursday night, A Voice for Men Radio, and you can access that through avoiceformen.com, which is a website that I've contributed to in the past, not recently. And I do actually, I think that definitely don't go in there and take all of those guides' word for it either. Always, always, always check your facts, look into things a little deeper, try and figure out if...
Do your grammar, is that what you're saying? Do your grammar before your logic.
There you go. And find out the who, what, when, where, and how before you ask why. And then I guess that's really it. I guess I just... Those are the places that I hang out online. I hang out on Reddit a little bit too, on the R Men's Rights subreddit, which is deeply unpopular in certain circles, but maybe circles that I would rather they be unpopular in, so.
Well, I may be biased, but I can't thank you enough for what you do. I really appreciate it.
Oh, well, thank you. It's kind of a labor of love, and it's definitely something that I find extremely stimulating and interesting, so it almost doesn't seem like work. And yes, I am planning on writing a book, so.
Well, that's good, you know, and I assume you're not talking about a romance novel, right?
I have written a few of those.
Oh, yeah, I know. That's what I was teasing you about. Or you know, maybe you could write a romance novel that actually incorporates all of this so that the women that read those at the supermarket stand get this stuff.
Well, what I have found is that feminists and women really are able to tolerate the idea of female agency and accountability and actual empowerment, like empowered through your own efforts rather than people helping you. They can really tolerate that when it's presented in fiction. Enter real life and present those ideas, you are persona non grata. You are like the devil. But and Warren Farrell had actually, Warren Farrell, he wrote The Myth of Male Power and several other books. He had actually suggested that I try and write fiction with these themes, and it just doesn't seem to be calling to me. But I did have an agent with an extremely large and reputable agency contact me and ask me to please write him a book proposal. So
I would agree with that. It needs to get out there, you know. Even if it's not calling you, we got to encourage you to find it.
Well, being in the industry and knowing how rare it is that an agent will actually solicit material from you, and then going to their website and seeing that they weren't a fly by night or, you know, some kind of scammer, they were actually like a big name. That was a little bit surprising, but I'm definitely looking at doing that, and that's definitely in the works. So,
thank you so much.
Well, thank you guys for having me. It's been really nice chatting. I think we went a little long, but
indeed we did. And you just have so much good stuff. And I thought about asking you if you wanted to split it into two, but you know, maybe we can still do another show or two in the near future.
That might be good. I definitely can be talkative. I'm sorry.
Oh, that's quite all right. You know, I don't like to cut shows off and guests off, and I always give guests the floor because it's, you know, that's what this show is based on and that's what the audience wants. And, you know, I know a lot of people really appreciate the depth and scope that you brought to this issue today.
Well, I just hope I've made people ask questions and encouraged them or inspired them to actually go and look and find more questions to ask. Because I think this is one of those things where it's almost like it has to be a personal discovery for a lot of people, a personal epiphany. So,
yeah.
Go.
Indeed.
All right.
All right, Karen, thank you so much.
Thank you, guys.
Have a good day.
You too. Take care.
Bye-bye.